Al Jazeera Podcasts.
Standoffs between police and Palestine solidarity protesters on U.S. college campuses are intensifying. Violent confrontations are giving rise to fears of outside interference, and politicians are taking sides. How will these protests affect President Joe Biden's bid for a second term? I'm Nastasia Tay, and you're listening to the Inside Story podcast, where we dissect, analyze, and help define major global stories. Well, let's now bring in our guests. Niambi Carter is an associate professor in public policy at the University of Maryland. She specializes in racial and ethnic politics, and she joins us today from Washington, D.C. In Boston, we have Rami Khoury, a political analyst and distinguished public policy fellow at the American University of Beirut. And also in Washington, D.C. is James Davis. He's a Republican strategist who has advised major corporations, NGOs and governments around the world. A very warm welcome to all of you. Thank you for joining us today on Inside Story. Now, especially given what we've seen in the last few days at UCLA and in New York, it feels like the response, the escalating response to what we're seeing on college campuses around the U.S., that's almost galvanizing more action. So we've got this growing movement, not just individual protests, but now what seems to be a movement in an election year. Rami, I know you've been speaking to a lot of students who have been involved in these demonstrations. Do you get the sense that this is just the beginning?
Yeah, it is. I've been involved in campus activities, media stuff, public policy debates in the U.S. for the last 55 years, since 1968, when I was a freshman, when I was a sophomore at Syracuse University. And ever since then, I've been involved in debates with, like, you know, Hillel students or media debates or whatever, and nonstop in the last 55 years. And I can tell you, this is the most dramatic moment in terms of how the Palestine-Israel issue intersects with American domestic politics and trends. The reason is that since 1968, which was a dramatic year for protests and the Chicago Convention of the Democrats, etc., the Democratic Party has slowly, slowly built up a coalition of marginalized people, Arab Americans, African Americans, Muslim Americans, Hispanic Americans, labor unions, students, and some other groups, some church groups. And these people have been organizing for 40 years, getting voters registered. We saw the impact of that in the primaries in Michigan a few months ago and other primaries. For the first time, this group of, let's call it, they're not all ethnic minorities, but marginalized minorities are now working together, and they threaten the Democratic Party's incumbency. We don't know what's going to happen in November, but we do know that there is now a huge ideological crack in the United States. It's been there for a while, if you look at, you know, MSNBC and Fox, but this has now gone on to the local level, the public level, and it's just incredibly powerful as a confrontation. Hopefully it'll stay peaceful. It has been from the protesters' side yesterday and the day before. We had some thugs, pro-Israeli groups, who were attacking students in UCLA and other places. But this is unbelievably important. It's the first time that Palestine-Israel has become a domestic American political issue. Where it goes depends on how the battle now will come out, whether the elite establishment forces will prevail, or the protesters and their huge national coalition will prevail.
Rami, just to clarify something for our viewers, because you have been speaking to student protesters involved right now on campuses, there's been a lot of allegations of outside interference, of people coming in and instigating violence or other kinds of activities on campus. Are you hearing about any of that from your students?
Not really. Some of them say that occasionally some people try to come in and influence them and this and that. But there's no more outside influence in this than there is in the American Congress or the American media. When you look at external forces that try to influence them, usually in legal ways, lobbying, advertising, et cetera, pressuring them, outside influence is a part of public life and politics, especially in the Arab-Israeli-Palestine-Israel conflict. But the students I've talked to in about 12 universities across the U.S. in the last 3-4 months have been remarkably focused, clear, and violent. And the coalition that I mentioned globally, nationally, is reflected at the level of the protesters, especially with the progressive Jewish students, African-Americans, and others. Mm-hmm.
You talk about this very organized student movement. I mean, universities in the US have historically had a very deep culture of activism. It's supposed to be a safe space, right? Like, we know this from, well, the Vietnam War, what happened at Columbia, for instance. We've seen this over the course of many, many generations at American universities. This time, though, we are also now seeing faculty get involved. We're seeing divisions within the Democratic Party, people taking sides. Nyambi, I'm curious for your thoughts on this. Mm-hmm. How deep do you think the rifts are that we're seeing develop within universities, within the Democratic Party, within these, well, how Rami described it as previously marginalized groups who've previously come together?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, part of where faculty have responded is because of the escalation by some campuses with calling in police and National Guard. And, you know, I think many faculty feel like it's their responsibility to protect these children. I mean, they're still children. I mean, I know we call them adults, but they're still young people. And many times we have as much, if not more, contact than these young people with these young people than their own families, because many of them are far from home. We see them at scheduled times week over week, and we build relationships with them. So when you see them being zip tied and in some cases brutalized, yeah, I think a lot of faculty of conscience, I mean, whether they are on one side of the debate or other, or the other, I think what is important is that many felt that they'd be there to support students, that universities should not be in the business of calling in state authorities to repress what is their constitutional right to protest and to speech. I think it's been very concerning because as this has unfolded, I think there have been lots of ways in which the protests and terminology or even just the protests themselves, right, have been used to talk about, you know, the atmosphere on campus. And to me, that is just, as a faculty member from where I sit, code for we want to fundamentally change university systems by people who typically don't care about universities, who definitely don't care about young people, and certainly have not spent a lot of time on a university campus in a while. And I think part of the reason why this is so, I don't know, concerning, distressing, or even surprising for some is the fact that, one, we don't have a lot of expectation sometimes out of young people. We chide them for being disengaged. And when they engage, we say they don't know enough. They're ignorant. They're wrong. They're being, you know, brainwashed, all kinds of derogatory things. But these people are engaged. This is the George Floyd generation, if you will. And part of why these, I think, these particular protests have gained so much traction is one, because I don't think we ever thought that there would be a place where one could be nuanced or thoughtful in a critique of the state of Israel, but also because the university's unwillingness to just sort of let this thing play out has escalated and spread these attacks. What most people don't get is the semester is winding down for most of us. We only have a week or two left of school. It was highly unlikely that students were going to stay behind and protest over the summer. Sure. But when you start calling it NYPD and LAPD and other things and zip tying students and throwing them in jail cells, then you made this a real thing. And I'm saying it wasn't real before, but now you have hardened their resolve. Right. To continue this. And there are a lot of solidarity protests that came up as a result. So I think this was a supreme miscalculation by both the Democratic Party, yes, but also from university leadership in many cases.
You talk there about a miscalculation. I mean, arguably, it was also the series of congressional hearings, right, that really intensified these protests and then the subsequent reaction Absolutely. That we've seen from administrators since then. James, I'm curious how much you think this has all been driven by political considerations, especially the response we've seen from university management.
Well, I think it's driven by political considerations, but the political considerations come from the fringe of the what is the Democratic Party and the divide within the Democratic Party over what the public policy landscape should look like in regards to Israel and Palestine. It is a big divide for Joe Biden. His base is completely wedged on this issue, and he's been kind of playing in the middle of the road on this, and he's kind of become roadkill in the middle of the road. Because he has no base on either side. I just saw video of students on both sides of the debate on a college campus, you know, chanting explicit against Joe Biden, both of them back and forth. So he's not winning with either coalition there. I think overall there's been a vacuum of leadership at the university system level and then obviously in the White House here. When we talk about free speech, it's important to remember, like, yes, we want to teach our young people how to champion and lift up their voice and bring passion and spirit to the debate. But if they're taking over property, if they are intimidating or harassing other students, that's not okay. And that's when law enforcement, unfortunately, has to get involved for the protection of property rights and individuals. It's not fair to the individuals who paid a ton of money to go to some of these institutions to get their education to have it disrupted by that, right? They're trying to prepare for their vocation, and you know, you're basically taking from them. Some of them are having really seminal moments in their life, that like education or like their graduations being canceled at this point.
We've started
That's
seeing that.
Not right.
Well, perhaps unsurprisingly, in an election year, we are already hearing from President Donald Trump on this. Let's take a listen to some of what he's had to say.
College president, I say remove the encampments immediately, vanquish the radicals, and take back our campuses for all of the normal students who want a safe place from which to learn.
Well, that's certainly not the most strident language we've heard from him on this. But James, let me throw this to you as a Republican strategist. I mean, the party must be pretty delighted watching all of this unfold.
Well, I think politically it does put puts Joe Biden in a really tough spot, puts Trump in a strong spot. And to his credit, he's run a very good campaign this time around. You know, the recent poll from Monmouth asked Americans how they viewed this matchup. Were they excited about this matchup of Joe Biden versus Donald Trump, this rematch? And 36% of Democrats said no, 66% of Republicans said yes, and then 27% of independents said yes. So, I mean, there's a huge delta in these numbers, and it shows the enthusiasm gap that Joe Biden's already facing. And that's in the – all this is happening on top of the Bidenomics and increased inflation, cost of living, all of those things. So this is just more fuel to the fire. It looks very eerily similar to the Black Lives Matter movement from 2020, except for it's breaking the opposite way right now.
It's interesting because we're still just over 6 months from the November elections. And obviously, foreign policy doesn't usually feature massively highly on the top of voters' priority lists when they're going to the ballot box in the US. I've been looking at some of the numbers as well, particularly when it comes to young voters. Harvard Institute of Politics youth poll, it says Gaza and what's happening there ranks 15th on the list of top issues facing young voters. I mean, that's fairly low down the list. Well below the economy and immigration, according to that survey. Rami, do you think what's happening, what we're seeing happen now in the response on college campuses will actually change voting behavior?
Well, it already has. We saw it in the primaries in several states. It's not definitive, but the primaries where people said it's registered as uncommitted was a warning sign. It wasn't a full vote. But it's a very important warning sign because it was replicated in about five or six other states. So the Palestine-Israel issue is now a domestic issue in an election year. And what's significant is what Niambi said, I think was very important. This is the first time in modern history, and I don't exaggerate because I've experienced this whole history since I was a student in 1968. It's the first time that people in the United States on some mainstream media, but mostly on social media and alternative media and progressive media, but mostly on the ground where they live, are able to discuss the issue of Palestinian rights, Israeli policies, and American complicity in the war in Gaza now. This has never happened before. So you're seeing this desperate attempt by the what I call the power elite. And I disagree a little bit with James in the sense that there's no real difference between the Republicans and the Democrats when it comes to Middle East policy. There are minor little things here and there. But when you see Biden's enthusiastic support for the war, there's no real difference at all. So you have a power elite that is really across parties. The media, the mainstream media, is central to this, and the corporate world is central to this. They are desperately trying now to discredit the demonstrators with saying there's outside infiltrators and there's this and that. I've watched this closely every day. I've watched this, and I just wrote an op-ed on this that's coming out in a few days, that they're desperately using, you know, the same tactics that come out of the pro-Israeli propaganda book, that discredit them as terrorists, they're Hamas lovers, they're Nazis, this is the worst thing Israel has experienced since the Holocaust. Those are views that people are free to hold. It just happens to be they're not accurate, and this exaggeration and all these attempts to desperately stop the discussion in public about Israel's behavior or American complicity in the war. So this is the battle that's taking place. It's really a battle between the forces who want to weaponize anti-Semitism to silence Palestinians and progressive voices in the U.S., and of course to change American policies to stop being so war happy. And on the other side, people fighting for justice for the Palestinians and peaceful, equal rights for Israelis and Palestinians. You're getting these incredible statements by the president himself and the head of the Congress, the House of Representatives, and these sort of, you know, mad statements that this is, people are talking about hate speech to annihilate Israel and kill the Jews. This is total, absolute lies and nonsense. It's hysteria. But it's hysteria in the center of the power structure. And
Rami,
it has to be...
I just want to pick up on something you said earlier. Just very briefly, I'm curious about whether you think, given what we've seen on campuses and what we've seen in terms of voting behavior in the primaries, whether any of the protests that we're seeing in the growing movement, whether that might actually shift any administration policy?
I think it will. I think we will see it, but it's not going to happen quickly. One of the things that I've learned, and I'm lecturing and writing on this now, in the last 45 years, 50 years I've followed this, is that policy change happens slowly. Social activism happens quickly. Mm-hmm. Reaction to social activism happens quickly. Media stuff happens quickly, but policy change happens slowly. I remember in the 60s and early 70s, I watched the women's movement expand, civil rights movement reach a peak, the environmental movement be born, and the anti-Vietnam War movement be born. Those movements took 10, 20, 30 years to make real policy changes. And so we have to look at this as a part of a slow-moving process that, yes, I think there will be changes, but they'll take time.
Well, part of that movement for change is about voting. Niambi, let me ask you about what would be a progressive youth vote here and how much that's going to impact Biden in November. If you're a progressive youth voter, what is your calculus? If you're this disillusioned and this angry at the Biden administration and the White House, do you vote Trump, knowing what he might do in office, or do you just not vote at all?
I think one of the things that they are not as persuaded by this go-round as they were in 2020 is the fear. You have to give people something more than just being fearful of the outcome. Some people might say, hey, we had 4 years of Donald Trump. It was terrible, but we lived through it. It's fine. And I think, you know, some people think there'll be another vote. I think we can never hang our hats on that, right? I mean, we've seen it in other countries. People always think that there's another chance to vote. But when you have someone who's suggested at least that they're committed to being more autocratic, I don't know that we can hang our hats on that. But I think these young people are willing to gamble that because they are not inspired by the Democratic coalition. They're not inspired by Joe Biden. They don't care for him as a candidate. Many people think he's too old, he's out of touch. And certainly this issue is not just about sort of Israel and Hamas and all of that. It's also about how the police state has been used against these kids. I mean, it's about a lot of things and their disillusionment with housing, with the cost of living, inflation, et cetera. So I think if there is a choice, I think a lot of people will knowingly stay home, understanding that this could be a problem should Donald Trump win in the fall. But we have to also know that there are down ballot races that those kids might also be willing to engage with. Mm-hmm. So no, I may not vote for either of these people as president, but I will vote for my state legislatures, my city council people, because those are becoming much more attractive, I think, venues for the kind of change and the immediacy that these young people seek. But also these are places where it seems like these candidates have more room. It's not as bought and paid for as the two-party dominant system that we see when we talk about the presidential races.
Speaking of the candidates, I want to bring in James here. As a political strategist, if you were advising the Biden White House right now on how to de-escalate the situation, we've seen that really only happen at a couple of universities, at Brown and Northwestern, who promised votes on divestment or greater transparency. But we haven't heard at all from the president himself. We haven't heard at all from Joe Biden at this stage. What would you be advising him and his administration to do right now?
Well, the reason you haven't been hearing from him is because he doesn't do a great job when he comes out and gives public speeches. And his administration is really trying to, his team is trying to really handle him with really tight leash right now. And I think ultimately you're going to have him go out and make a forceful case one way or another, which way he's going to go on this public policy debate, because right now he's standing in the middle and no one's happy. So they're going to have to make a decision here to placate one side or the other. They're trying to have it both ways and they can't. The problem here is the same problem you see with a lot of corporations in America, where, you know, the leadership wants to go one direction, but an employee base wants to go another direction, or at least some radical portion of an employee base wants to go a different direction. And they make a lot of noise, particularly on social media, and that travels fast. And then you got to have responses to all of that. And I think that's the problem. His base isn't aligned on this issue. It's a super wedge issue. When you're talking about the impact on the race and what's going to happen, you're looking at, you know, roughly 10,000 or so votes difference in across seven states that will impact the outcome of this election if you were to go back and look at the 2020 voting rolls. And if you look at all the polls right now, Trump is good bit ahead of Joe Biden in those swing states already. So all you need to do is turn it out at the margin. We're talking 10,000 votes. Yeah. That's nothing.
And it's already going to be a closely fought election. What we're seeing now will only make it more so. I'm sure you all agree. Thank you, though, for a very interesting discussion today to all of our guests, Niambi Carter, Rami Khoury and James Davis. This episode was produced by Shantanu Chatterjee, Katia Lopez-Horoyan, Michael Harwood and Gemma Harries. Studio sound by Alexander Chigreen. This program was edited by Vishnu Sheila, Lin Yuan, and Joe DeFrias. Do be sure to subscribe to the Inside Story podcast to catch every episode. Thanks for listening and tune in again on Friday for our next one.
Coming up on The Take, Israel is warning senior officials may face imminent prosecution by the International Criminal Court. Why? That's The Take by Al Jazeera. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.